I'm Piers Corbin. I'm the director of Weather Action, long range weather forecasters. I'm also a campaign activist to fight against the Great Reset and the world fascism that entails. My origins in science are that I was very interested in science at school and at home, and set up a weather station when I was a kid, and always looked at the stars. After I got glasses where I could see them through, got a Royal Scholarship to Imperial College, and then got a first class degree in physics with the theoretical option, and then did some research into solid state physics, and then went off to Queen Mary College and did an MSc in astrophysics. So I've done a lot of research into solar activity and long-range forecasting, and it involves the moon modulating the solar wind, which is the rush of particles which come from the sun and affect the jet stream, which affects our weather a lot.
You've done a lot of work on the potential for the sun to be changing, and in fact,
Yes.
you've built this weather business basically on this
Yes,
ability of the
completely.
sun to affect the weather here. And so, if you're looking at the sun closely, then you can see, well, hang on, there's some solar wind heading in our direction, which is going to change the weather. But before we talk about that, because that is a
Yep.
fascinating topic in itself, can you just explain what it is that? So, one of the things I find quite mind blowing is it's like listening to Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. You look up there, and if you see an eclipse, if you're lucky enough to see a
Yeah.
lunar eclipse, you actually see the moon go past the sun or across the sun, and you can see a kind of tiny amount of like flame around the, is it the corona,
Yeah.
around the edge of the moon. These two disks, one of them is 400 times further away than the other one, but they're both exactly the same size of the
Exactly.
sky. And the same with the Earth. So if the Earth goes past, and you're looking at the moon, then the Earth blots the moon out, but it doesn't blot it completely out. It just blots it out just correctly. So this does, I mean, it starts to look as if this is designed. So the coincidences are astronomical. I don't know, that's maybe not the right word to use in this context,
Well, it is,
but they
okay, but
are
yes.
enormous, aren't they?
Was the moon put there? What you're correct. What you've noticed about a solar eclipse is that the in fact there's three types of eclipses. There's a total solar eclipse where the moon exactly covers the sun, and there's ones which are where it's looks slightly bigger or slightly smaller, and the ones where it's slightly smaller are called penumbral eclipses, I think. So then you can see the fire of the sun around it. And this, of course, depends very precisely on the distance of the moon from the Earth, which varies because the moon's orbit is around the Earth is elliptical. But it's a small difference, but it is significant. But the average, of course, is that they fit exactly. And as you pointed out, that the, 400 times the distance, and it's a 400th of the size, and
Well,
so
we
on.
can imagine why the ancients were studying this, because they must have been
Yeah.
scratching their heads thinking, crikey, if there's an eclipse, it's sometimes it's the sun disk is slightly smaller than the
Yeah.
moon as the moon goes past the sun,
Yeah.
and sometimes it's slightly bigger. We better figure this out.
Yeah. Well, there is not an explanation for this, but there are some other explanations that we've developed for some aspects of the moon, because there's another thing which is really absolutely astounding, namely that the moon, you see, its orbit relative to the Earth's orbit is tilted. So, therefore, the moon's orbit crosses the Earth's orbit in two places. And that, of course, that only, when it does that, you can then have an eclipse because the moon's orbit has to be at the same level. So that is a possibility. And furthermore, the position of crossing, which is called a node where it crosses, has to be on the Sun-Earth line. So then you get an eclipse.
So, can you
Right?
just explain the
So
different
that's why
terminology? Because
an
we've got
eclipse is
different
called
sorts of eclipses, haven't we? We've got one eclipse where the Earth goes in between the Sun and the Moon, and then we've got another type of eclipse where the
Yeah.
Moon goes between the Sun and the Earth.
Yes, that's right. When the moon goes between the sun and the Earth, we have a solar eclipse. when the Earth goes between the Sun and the Moon, we have a lunar eclipse. So those are the two types. The lunar eclipse is what you see is the, you first of all see the Moon going sort of darker and then getting completely covered, because there's an umbra and a penumbra, a shadow and a partial shadow, you see. When you see the Moon crossing the Sun's disk in the solar eclipse, you see, first of all, a partial eclipse and a bit of the Sun is bitten out. And then if it's lined up correctly, then you'll see a total eclipse. There is quite a lot of partial eclipses, of course, where it doesn't happen exactly right. Those are called partial eclipses. So they're all tabulated and calculated.
Yeah, so you have to go get on a plane and go to a different part of the world to see it properly.
You do. And then you need a long-range weather forecast from me to know whether it's going to be sunny or not.
Yes, that's true. Or else you need to be somewhere like in the Andes, whatever, where there's hardly above the...
Well, I saw the last eclipse in the last millennium. And we had to go to Hungary for that. And I was with my wife at the time, and I said, well, that's the place to go. If you stay in England, it's going to be cloudy and a waste of time. And we were right. We did go there, and we did see it, and it was amazing. Whereas lots of people in England were running around in Cornwall looking at grey skies and getting very bored.
Okay, so can you just tell us what it is about this that is so incredible and amazing and mind-blowing I suppose it's a kind of thing of geometry, really, that the idea that the Sun can be so, 400 times further away, and yet we now know that. Of course, the ancients didn't. And in a way, we've seemed to have forgotten these incredible phenomena today.
We have. Yes. Now, there isn't an explanation as to why it is that size. There might be an explanation in terms of the solar wind. I don't know. But you see, it's just a marvel. That's what I can say. It's a marvel.
Well, I think we just have to say it's an incredible coincidence. Some would say it's evidence for intelligent design.
Yes, of course. It is an argument for intelligent design, yes. But there's something else which could also be an argument for intelligent design, but we have an explanation for it. And this is really quite amazing, and it isn't something that's well publicised. Namely, that I mentioned the nodal crossings, right? So the Moon crosses the orbit of the Earth twice in its orbit. It goes below it and then goes round again and comes above it. And the period from crossing, going down, and then up and then down again, for example, is 27.21 days. Okay? And that is, closely measured. Now, another thing that happens, when you look at the Sun and you watch spots on the Sun, they come round at the latitude where they're most common, when you look at them, they come round and come round again with a period of 27.2 days, namely the same. And that is absolutely incredible. And there's
so
only
you're
one
suggesting
other...
that that's the speed at which the Sun is rotating is the same speed at which the Moon is tilting backwards and forwards in its orbit.
Yes, that is. It's exactly the same. But that's when you view it from Earth. If you view it from another planet, which goes at a different speed around the Sun, because the Sun is spinning, then you're going to see a different relative speed. Now, they are the same. That is incredible. Now, there's one other planet-lunar pair where something of this nature happens, namely Pluto and the Moon Charon. And the ratio there of the observed spin of the Sun from Pluto to the crossing of Charon, the period of that, is 4.0. So it's a whole number. Instead of being one in the case of the Earth, it's exactly four. And all the other planets going around, moons going around planets, there's no special relationship at all. Now, these two things, the Charon and Pluto as one pair, and the Moon and the Earth as another pair, are very interesting things in that they're both comparable sized bodies, i.e. the Moon is very large, compared with the Earth, compared with, say, the moons of Jupiter, which are like specks of dust around a mountain, and Charon and Pluto are the ratios are even bigger than for the Earth. So something going on which has shifted the orbit. Now, our understanding of that is it's a thing about transfer of angular momentum, which is carried by the solar wind. So I can't go into the arguments now, but you look at them, and there is something going on which causes a feedback mechanism. So the moon would have been moved around by the solar wind to fit exactly that way.
Now, so you're saying this wind is blowing the moon? Surely not.
Yeah, basically, yes. So the theory that the moon is always moving outwards from the Earth, which is probably incorrect.
You mean, you know, it's almost like a fan, you know, blowing it.
Something like that. It's a bit complicated to explain, but the solar wind interacting magnetically with the Earth and the moon makes it stay in that orbit exactly. And the idea that the moon's always moving away from us is probably untrue. Now, of course, this is controversial to people, but you see, at least what I'm saying, we can explain the 27.2 days, whereas there isn't any other explanation. The exact size now, been covering it, I don't know if you can explain that. I mean, it's a bit, well, it's just very interesting, and it might be about, you know, solar wind being reflected on the or bounce back.
Well, it does also strike me as it might be a creator's signature.
Well, yes, the 27.2 days though does have a physics explanation that I've just given you.
I think what you could probably do is to get somebody, you know, I don't know if it's me, but to actually work out the probability of these things happening by chance. But one thing,
well, you make many assumptions of that. Well, you'll just say this is, well, it depends how many decimal places you want to go to, but I mentioned three significant figures for that 27.2, and it's pretty closer than three, probably four or five, yeah, but there you are. I think it's also worth noting about just there's different things to understand about the moon's orbit, you see. So what I've told you about, the node-to-node orbit, that's 27.212 days, that's called the draconic month. And the synodic month is when you see the new moon to the new moon, which is different. That is 29.53 days, and they're very different because the moon's orbit is rotating as well. You see that is the plane of the moon's orbit rotate. So this nodal line is moving in space, you see, and it comes back to itself in pointing at the sun every 18.61 years. Now there's other months. The sidereal month for the moon is the motion of the moon from a fixed star to a fixed star, and that's 27.321662 days. And then there's the anomalistic month, which is the perigee of the moon to the orbit from the perigee when it's nearest the Earth to the perigee again. And that line, the line of anomaly, is moving too. So that month is 27.554 days. And then there's another one, the tropical month, equinox to equinox, 27.321582 days. So you might get bored with those figures, but you know, just looking at the moon, people think, oh yeah, full moon to full moon, that's it, 29.53 days. But actually there is five different months to understand.
Well, what about this whole thing of the dark side? Is that sounds a little bit strange.
Oh, that bit. No, that is very understandable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because most of these heavenly bodies, at least they're spinning slightly, but this one is apparently spinning at exactly the right speed, so that it always faces away, the dark side faces away.
That's right. No, that is understandable in terms of, it's because the moon is irregular in shape, and the tidal effect the moon has on the Earth causes it to become phase locked, and Charon and Pluto are also completely phase locked. Probably a lot of other moons. I don't know if moons of Jupiter are phase locked or not, but it's a tidal effect due to the distortions that the these moons are giving to their planets.
So how come that hasn't happened with the sun? Surely you'd expect the Earth to be phase locked with the sun, so you've got a kind of dark side of the Earth permanently.
Yes, I think, well, you have, yes, that's true, that could happen, but the tidal effect of the Earth onto the sun is very small. Mercury, though, is phase locked in a sense, in that its ratio of the spin, the spin rate to, yeah, the spin rate to the orbital rate is an exact ratio of whole numbers.
Oh, right. Well, that of course, is the closest planet to the sun.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, where such effect could be bigger. But the other planets haven't been around long enough for such an effect to come about. So it's also an interesting thing in arguments, because you can calculate the rates of these things to an extent. There's an argument fitting into the age of the solar system. I don't think there's any contradictions about that, but yes, it's these whole number things only come where the masses are, well, where for some reason the interactions can be more effective.
But I mean, there are quite a lot of moons in the solar system. It's interesting that it's just Earth and Pluto that have these phase-locked moons.
Well, and the reason is that they are of relatively similar size, like the Charon and Pluto are very similar sized objects. The Moon and the Earth are pretty similar in the scale of things, i.e., it's, you know, 10 or 100 or something, whereas the moons of other planets are tiny drops compared with the mass of the planet.
Now, you're a bit of an activist when it comes to to the lockdowns, the Great Reset. Do you want to just tell us how things are going with all of that and the fossil fuel people? Because I'm getting frustrated, particularly with the fossil fuel lobby. They seem to be campaigning very strongly to try and stop all use of fossil fuels in any way. And the trouble is that we haven't got an alternative yet. Ready. We've got wind power, which, by the way, Prince Charles is very behind wind power, partly because he gets paid for every wind farm that gets put out in the sea, because
exactly.
He owns the seabed. He's not Prince Charles, he's King Charles now, I know. But he owns
indeed.
The seabed. And so every wind farm is benefiting him personally. What about the latest activities on the Great Reset and trying to draw attention to some of the problems that is potentially causing?
Yes, well, first of all, to understand about fossil fuels, wind power, and I mentioned Lord Deben. Fossil fuels, of course, are not fossil fuels. Well, coal is a fossil and oil is not a fossil. And the idea of these things running out is well, there's 300 years of coal under the UK that could be used by the UK. Oil, though, will probably never run out and is been regenerated all the time deep down. The oil, you see, doesn't occur at the same levels down as the coal. It's much, much deeper. And there's no sign of any fossils of any form in any oil that comes out of the ground. So it's some other process, which the Russians made some artificial oil under great pressures and catalysts and so forth. Right, that's the first thing to understand. Second thing is about wind power. Well, of course, Prince Charles makes money out of wind power. And so do a lot of the people on the government's planet.
King Charles.
King Charles. Well, yes, including Lord Deben, the chair of it. And if you look at his interests, they're as long as your arm when it comes to interests in the climate lobby production of stupid ways of producing energy. Right. Now, when wind power doesn't blow, what is used as the alternative? The answer is diesel. There are diesel generators all over the country, and they have this system called the STOR system, STOR, and they turn these on when the wind doesn't blow. So all these Greenpeace or Just Stop Oil people are actually pro-diesel, so they wouldn't like to admit it.
I'm sure they would deny that. They're saying, you know, obviously we don't want to switch everyone's power off, aren't they? That we want to stop oil completely, ultimately, though.
Well, they're insane, of course. It can't be done, because if wind power, you've got to have an alternative when the wind doesn't blow or when the sun doesn't shine. Or maybe they want to go over to nuclear. Now, the origin of nuclear power was primarily to get plutonium to make nuclear bombs. People argue that modern nuclear power is safer. Well, in terms of disposal of the waste, I don't know if that's true or not, but you know, they would say that, wouldn't they? But I'm not going to say yes or no to that. But I think it's very important to understand now the role of the Just Stop Oil lobby, which, first of all, I say it's 110% backed by the oil lobby, because the effect of it is that oil prices are held artificially high by OPEC and others in order to make it worth a farmer selling food to be burnt as opposed to eaten, you know, like maize. So there's an artificial maintenance of price to make it suddenly oh so profitable to do these stupid things. So the oil companies, they're going to lose, or they've lost about 5% of world energy production, maximum, nothing more than that, in exchange for doubling the profit on 95% of energy supply. So it's a complete no-brainer that they go along with this, and they're also happy to be the fake whipping boys. I mean, it is disgustingly dishonest. And, you know, the rector or president, they would call themselves now, but the rector of Imperial College, whose name escapes me, she had a big consultation with Chevron, right? And that was kind of not very well known, and she was promoting all this alternative energy stuff, and then people denounced her for also having a consultation with Chevron. But you see, there's no contradiction whatsoever. Chevron are perfectly happy to promote the you know, the so-called green lobby, because it increases their profits. So, you know, but anyway, where is it all leading? That's the question you're asking, and this is really important. The complete madness going on now about energy crisis is going to be used as a justification for getting a world grip on the problem, which is going to be, first of all, we've got to control all countries in order to make sure they're green, and that means massive spending, and it has to be coordinated on a world scale, which requires a benevolent dictator. And they were even talking about this in LSE 2 days ago. A benevolent dictator who will give all the policies we need and administer all the money we need. And Prince Charles at the last COP conference was talking about exactly that, about somebody has to be in charge of trillions and trillions in order to make every country green compliant.
I think he was talking, Pierce, wasn't he, about a military style operation?
He was. This is new world tyranny, and coming on the back of saving the planet. It's actually destroying human life and democracy on the planet, and along with the jab, destroying a lot of human life itself.
Well, we've also had the announcement this week that fracking is all going to start again. I noticed some anti-fracking campaigners getting ready already to try and stop it.
Yes. Well, on fracking, I think it's a kind of, that's a thing they like to get us to jump around about. Personally, I think fracking is safe in countries where the geology allows it, so it doesn't involve polluting the water table. Now, there might be parts of America, or I think there are parts of America, where this is true. The United Kingdom, though, is such a very complicated geology because it's positioned relative to the main plates of motion of continental plates, that it's dangerous in the UK, and the water table gets mixed up. So I'm for, you know, stopping fracking in the UK, but I think it might be workable in some places, and doing more boring in the sea for oil and gas, like the North Sea, is perfectly sensible. But an even more sensible thing, frankly, would be digging coal mines again.
Okay, Piers Corbyn, I don't know if you've got anything to say about what you think is going to change now the Queen has gone and King Charles has taken over, because he's a major figure, isn't he, in the World Economic Forum?
Well, you see, he's got a choice here. We've got our new banner. We've got a little banner saying we want yes to the Magna Carta and no to the Terra Carta. Now, the Terra Carta is a World Economic Forum charter for things that have to be done, which includes zero carbon. So it's a green agenda to be used to control the world. And Prince Charles, of course, was promoting this some years ago. Now, I mean, he didn't write it himself. It's come from the World Economic Forum. But he has to choose, you see. Is he here to defend the independence of the United Kingdom, i.e. as the legal basis of which is really the Magna Carta, or is he here to destroy it and rule by something outside, which is the World Economic Forum Terra Carta? And if he goes along with the Terra Carta, then he should be removed. And we don't want a so-called monarch or a monarch who is so-called defending our sovereignty, when in fact he's giving it away to an external force.
Well, I know Princess Diana, in that famous interview that we're never supposed to watch again, with Martin Bashir in 1995 for the BBC, he was character assassinated for doing a brilliant interview. But she said, didn't she, that she said that, you know, Charles wants to change, to paraphrase her, Charles wants to change the world. And the role of king is you're apolitical. You're not allowed to do anything. So she thought that it would be too restrictive on him.
Yes. Well, that's true. She was a very observant woman, and it cost her a life, I would suggest. Yes. Well, King Charles can't have it both ways. If he's King of England, the United Kingdom, or indeed the Commonwealth, whatever that means these days, but King of the United Kingdom, he has to defend the sovereignty and independence of the United Kingdom. And we have to defend the Magna Carta, which may have inadequacies and we may want better things, but, you know, it certainly enshrines basic rights, whereas the World Economic Forum want to destroy our basic rights.
Since we've also had this week some rather worrying news from Ukraine about these new missiles that NATO is sending in there, and the Germans too, Putin is saying, well, look, if you're going to send these long-range missiles, which can go 50 to 100 miles, I mean, that's getting close to hitting Moscow, and they're getting quite annoyed, aren't they? So, I mean, this is a pretty... I mean, I'm quite worried, actually, that this sort of provocation could really escalate the war. And what Putin's done is called up this week 300,000 reservists. Now, this doesn't seem to be any sign of negotiations, does there, Piers?
No. Well, I think, you see, the Russians are winning, whatever the West says. There will be margins where the Russians are going to give back some land, I'm sure, or even be driven out. But, you know, they've got the peace they want, namely the East, the Donbass, and some of the South. And I should think Putin actually wants to draw a line now. But the West want to carry on this bleeding thing. You know, they don't mind how many Ukrainians lose their lives as well as Russians, because the war means they're both going to lose people. They want the war to carry on, or be seen to be carried on, to justify energy shortages or whatever, or food shortages, in order to make the chaos that they say can only be solved with a new world order. I mean, Hitler got into power using the same thing, that the politicians in Germany were pathetic, they were liars, they were corrupt, which is all true, they were denounced, and Hitler said, I will bring order from the chaos. And the World Economic Forum is intending to do the same thing by the same methods, but on a world scale. And the war is just one of these. I think they should decide to draw a line and say, okay, we accept that Russian-speaking people in the East can join Russia if they want. You know, but the West has a formula for continuing war.
In the BBC coverage this week, there are referendums about to take place in the areas on the east of Ukraine, which join Russia. So, I found the interesting thing about it was that the BBC coverage, they talked about the sham referendums. Well, how can you call it a sham referendum before it's even happened?
Well, that's crazy. You see, I'm sure the Russians will invite the EU and the UN to inspect the vote. I'm sure they will. And I'm sure it'll be a fair vote, because we know what people think there. But we know they've been attacked for 8 years, since 2014, I mean, lots of them have been killed by their own government. So they definitely want to be in Russia. They definitely want the Russian state to defend them. I mean, they'll vote overwhelmingly. They'll probably even vote 99% or say 90%. I don't know. But it'll be such an overwhelming vote that people will claim it's fixed. But I don't think it will be fixed at all. You know, there's plenty of MPs quite able to check these things, and I'm sure the Russians will invite them. See, did the BBC ask that? Are these going to be independent monitoring? Oh, I bet they didn't.
No, they just said it's sham elections. Anyway, look, Piers, how do people follow your politics and your, you know, your stop new normal, that sort of thing? Whereabouts are we finding online?
Three things I'll tell you about. One is I've now got a new Twitter, which hasn't been closed down yet. I had 40,000 followers before, and they closed it off. Now I've got 1,800 under my new name, which is at Real Piers Corbyn, all one word, at and Real, R-E-A-L, Piers, P-E-I-R-S, Corbyn, C-O-R-B-Y-N, all as one word. So please follow, and we put lots of stuff on there. The websites we act through is stopnewnormal.net, which is owned, if you like, by LetTheUKLive.com, which is a campaign organization as well as a political party. But the StopNewNormal.net carries most of the action and information about campaign events from all sorts of people happening around the country. And our aim is really to draw together all the disparate groups or parties or not parties or anti-parties in a kind of better understanding federation that will act when needed to, you know, take to the streets when there's another into lockdown, for example. But those are the three things. Also on Telegram and on Telegram we've got groups as well. Piers Corbyn Stop New Normal, for example, is one of the groups. It's easy to find.
Okay, Piers Corbyn, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you as always, Tony. It's amazing to have a discussion with you.